Welcome to My Horse Heart. Thank you so much for tuning in to listen today. I have a really special guest with me who I've known since I was a small girl. We went to elementary school together at Willingdon in Montreal, and it's been many years since I've seen her, and I'm very lucky that Victoria Corsos has agreed to do this interview with me today. Not only is it a wonderful opportunity, because from the sounds of it, her life has been quite the journey that I find incredibly inspirational. I only know a small piece, so I'm just as excited about this interview as I hope you are. But also so exciting for me because it's been so many years, and it's really wonderful to be looking at her right now on Skype as we record this interview. So welcome, Victoria. Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So I am, in addition to being one of your long-lost elementary school classmates, I am now a fourth-year medical resident at McGill. I have just finished my 3 years of internal medicine residency, and I'm starting a residency in hematology oncology. I'm also a cancer survivor who actually was always interested in this particular field of medicine, but had the experience of going through cancer herself at the age of 22 in the first year of my medical studies.
Wow. And so for our listeners to have this a little bit more in context, Victoria and I were in the same class, and I'm almost 30. And are you 30 already? Or
I just turned 30, yes.
Okay, happy belated. So that puts in context how significant what you just said is. Wow, that's a lot. So when you found out you were diagnosed and you found out what your life was going to be looking like, how did that sit with you?
Well, I actually found my lymph node that was probably the site of my cancer. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is for a long time was not actually considered a cancer. It's now considered a cancer, a lymphoma. It's a cancer that's normally quite gentle. It'll affect lymph nodes and it'll kind of snake down from your neck all the way down into the abdomen without affecting the organs too much. So often when it's identified, it's more advanced stage. But because it's a cancer that is produced by a very small amount of cancer cells that kind of produce normal cells, this is the reason why you question whether or not it actually is by definition a cancer, you don't often diagnose it until it's much later in its stage. And I had found my original lymph node almost a year before I started medical school while I was actually sitting in a 500-level hematology physiology class being taught by one of the hematologists who will now be one of my teachers at the Vic. And I'd always had a suspicion that something maybe was amiss with that. I had it looked into, and you know, the physician who I saw at the time wasn't worried. And I started to feel very sick when I had started medical school, but I kind of attributed that to moving out of school, to moving out of my home, to going through the classes and the rigorousness of what it takes to start in a medical program. I had symptoms that were progressing. I was having a difficult time breathing, and I was really, really tired. And that's how I ended up going to see a doctor at McGill Health and then being referred very quickly to the Royal Victoria Hospital, like the same day, and being told that I would probably be admitted to hematology. And I remember asking that doctor, I think I have lymphoma? And she's like, I think you do. And I remember being in the old Royal Victoria Hospital. Now there's a new hospital, but it was the old one, and sitting in a bed and having had a chest x-ray done, and then coming out of the chest x-ray room and being asked to come back and look and being told without seeing a doctor that I needed to go for a CT scan, and receiving the paper from the nurse that said that I had a mass in my lung. And I remember that at that moment when I was preparing to go for the CT scan, I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, you're not going to be a medical student anymore. You're going to be a patient. And I felt that very strongly when I was going into the CT scan. So it was something that, I mean, I was devastated because I'd worked so hard to go into medicine, and I was so excited and I felt like I had so much to give. And I was terrified because I knew that I had cancer. I didn't know all the specifics, so I didn't know whether or not it affected my lung. What did that mean? And I was also kind of determined because I said, you know, well, if you're going to hand me a disease, then I'm going to take this opportunity. I'm going to use it to learn so I can be a better doctor. And those were kind of, I would say, the three initial feelings that I had on that day when I went through my initial testing and when the hematology fellow eventually came down to tell me that they thought that I had Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Wow. And what did it actually mean? What did it look like, that journey for you?
Well, so I think that in many ways, it was a very positive experience, what I went through, in the sense that being at 22, entering into a field where you deal with a lot of people who are sick, a lot of people who have losses, a lot of people that are dying, especially in internal medicine, where we deal with patients that have a lot of chronic disease. I think that going through the experience of having to give up that identity for a while as a medical student, entering into a patient identity, and also going through a lot of the transformative things that cancer puts you through, where, you know, you lose control of your body, you lose control of your ability to interact with the outside world, because especially with hematological malignancies, your immune system is so down all the time. So having to give all those things up and kind of enter into the world of a cancer patient and going for treatments every two weeks, and being in there every week for blood tests and having some time to kind of reflect on what's important to you because you're facing a life and death situation, and realizing that honestly, you know, the best things that you don't know what life has in store for you. You know, you're given a certain amount of time on this earth. You don't necessarily know how much time that is, but of what time you have, you best do things that are, that fulfill you and that fulfill the people around you who love you. And I think that in that year, I really realized the people who really cared about me and who were going to be there to help me grow. And when I went back into medical school, I had a very, you know, different perspective because I had just gone through a life-death experience. So my relationship with my patients, my desire to be someone who could be clinically very sharp, who could identify patients suffering, patients in situations where they needed to have these discussions, to give them what they needed to do to make the right decisions with the time that they had left. Because, you know, I think a lot of people go into medicine thinking that they want to cure everyone, or they want to cure a disease, or they want to make it better. And that's not the reality of what we do. The reality is we have certain tools that we can use to help our patients. And then at some point, the only thing that we can do to help them is to help them with the time we have left. And I've really kind of spent the last, I would say, is it 8 years, fostering that sort of approach to clinical medicine. So it's made me clinically very rigorous, because you have to be very in tune to what you're doing to make sure that you're making the right decisions for your patients, and also the human aspect of helping them and knowing how to have difficult conversations with them. And that has translated into research that I'm now doing, which is looking at the end-of-life period for hem-onc patients, because this is actually, to this day, 10 years later, a big source of difficulty for physicians and patients. So that's what, going forward, even now in my actual career, I see me kind of focusing on and doing education around that for other doctors.
Okay. So would that be like in a palliative care situation, or specifically with the hematology related patients?
I think it's both. As oncology and hem-onc have kind of progressed as fields, palliative care involvement has become something that we actually bring in at the same time as actively treating patients. And that's in part to help deal with this reality of the particular pathway that these kinds of diseases take people, and the journeys that they take people on. So, you know, we're trying to establish a better system for that in our own hospitals. And I want to help do that for our patients. I want to make them have more access to resources so that they can discuss these things, and also so that when we get to a point where we've tried many different treatments and maybe more treatment is not an option, that the conversation is easier and smoother, and we help them fulfill the things that they need to do before they pass away. I think that this is something that we have trouble doing here in Quebec and in our hospitals, and that I want to help with, actually.
Yeah, and I'm sure you are. I'm excited to see where you take that. Yeah. So what would be some examples you could share with us that really reflect the special experience and incredible intuitiveness I'm sure that you now carry because of your experiences, how you're able to bring that to your patients?
I think that a lot of the time as a young resident, and even as a medical student, I remember that the reason that I wanted to go into internal medicine was not necessarily because I wanted to become a hematologist, but was because I was on that ward and I was seeing, there was a patient that I was seeing that had he didn't actually have cancer. He had many other medical problems with his heart and his lung and his liver. And it looked like he wasn't going to be able to make the weekend. And it was a Friday afternoon. And I realized that a lot of the specialist doctors had come to see him, but no one had actually told the family what was going on. So I went in and I spoke to the family. I asked them if they knew what was going on. And I told them the truth of what I thought was the reality. And I remember the family member thanking me very much for coming and being honest so that she knew that she had this time left with her husband and she could have the conversations that she wanted to have with him. And I remember leaving the room and going to speak to the senior resident and letting them know, because they had been concerned about this, the fact that the patient didn't know. And I said, listen, I initiated this discussion, and now let's get the palliative care team involved. Let's try to focus on what the patient needs. And my colleague, I realized that the R2 or the much older resident had much less comfort with the situation than I did. So now as a resident, I really try to teach this to my medical students and to my younger residents, this approach of how to be honest with patients, because it's very hard for doctors to feel comfortable to tell patients always and always know what conversations they need to be had. Yeah. So this is, I think, one way that it plays out in my patient interactions.
And I would imagine it takes a really fine-tuned sensitivity and awareness of the other person or people that you're speaking to phrase it and approach it in a way that isn't over-dramatizing but isn't, you know, lacking clarity and information, and being able to step away from that situation and still be okay yourself.
Yes, that's very true. There's a lot of what we call debriefing that you have to do around these situations. And I would say that as we've gone along and as our specialties have progressed, our generation of doctors and of young residents are much more comfortable with these things. And that's in part because we talk about them. And it, when you become the teacher who teaches and it just comes down the line, I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a huge like revolution in this area, which is like super positive, that opens the lines of discussion and that makes people realize that there is a certain sensitivity to which you can to approach these difficult questions and communications with people, and to see them as people. And I'm very proud of my colleagues also who have helped in making this change in some of the hospitals that we work in.
Before you were diagnosed and before you went through all your treatments, do you think you would have had the same level of awareness and sensitivity with the patients naturally, or do you think that really developed through that experience?
That's a very interesting, a difficult question to answer. And I remember actually having this conversation with one of my staff who knew me from both ends. And she wasn't, her and I decided that we weren't quite sure that I think part of me was always like that. I think part of me, I went into medicine because my father had a stroke, and I watched him lose a lot of his functioning and his capacity initially with the stroke and then come back. And I saw how my family dynamics changed. And I think growing up had a very keen sense of that human aspect of medicine from a different perspective as a family member. So I came in with that. I came in with that interest or that knowledge of what people go through outside of the clinical textbook. So I think it's a combination of having that awareness and also what going through cancer myself gave me, though, was courage. It gave me the ability to not be afraid of the patients and what they're going through, to not be afraid to be honest with them, because I had been on the other side as the patient. I was actually also part of the first young adult support group at the Royal Victoria Hospital. When I was going through my training, we were the first young adult group, so up to 35 years old, going through all hematological cancers. So I had the privilege of sitting there and listening to other people's stories and listening to what they wanted from their doctors, and also recognizing that, you know, I, in my internal head, I had a very clear idea of what was going on with my body. I didn't necessarily need a doctor to tell me, but it would have been helpful to have the doctor be able to interact with me on that level. And I heard that that echoed in a lot of my colleagues or friends that were part of this group. And I think that all those experiences gave me the courage to want to interact with people on that level and to teach about this as I went through my internal medicine training and now hopefully in my hematology fellowship as well.
Did you ever have a moment where you doubted that you would go back to medical school and become a doctor yourself?
I think that I definitely had moments. When I went, because I finished my treatments, it was the end of July of 2011, went through 6 months, and then I went back to school in early January in a new medical class. And I was it was very difficult to go back having been acutely aware of having just been a cancer patient. So I didn't have a very good grasp of my identity after that cancer experience. And I think that transition point is really hard for a lot of people. A lot of people identify the diagnosis time and the treatment time as a hard time for people. And I think that's kind of common knowledge in society, because cancer has a very strong social life. But what we don't talk about so much is once you're done, when all the treatments are done, when you're trying to go back into your own body, but your body's not quite the same because now you have a catheter that's under your skin that wasn't there before, and your hair is gone and your body's changed, and you have this acute awareness that this thing can now come back. So that there were certainly moments when I went back to medical school in that first year where I was afraid. I was afraid, I was sad, I was going through a lot of emotions, but I always focused on the idea that this experience had taught me something, and that I was meant to go back and I was meant to do this. And that's what kept me going. And even I think in general, even in now as a resident and as a heme fellow, I always feel that challenge. Not that I'm not meant to be a doctor, but the challenge of being a really good, balanced hematologist who's as clinically rigorous as she is, humanly rigorous. And I think that's always a challenge that I'm up for, but that I to this day definitely feel, and probably in the next year will feel a lot more, because I'm entering into this 4-year program. I've done, 4 years of medical school, 5 years because of what I went through, 3 years of internal medicine, and now there's still 4 years to go. So now if you talk to me in 6 months from now, I'd like to see, it'd be interesting to see how I'm feeling. I'm sure I'll feel that pressure, which I think is good. Because both are important.
Yeah. The motivation along with trying to find the balance.
Yes.
How do you integrate self-care into your incredibly busy medical resident life?
Oh, that's a challenge. I think that there's definitely been parts of my residency where that self-care has not happened. Because you're constantly on call, you're constantly doing nights. There's many times when you're on 21 days in a row and you're back and you're forth and you don't see your family. You don't interact with your boyfriend, even if he lives with you. So self-care to me is really kind of trying to detach. So I actually just come back from being away for 2 months. I was on vacation with my fiance, and we had a chance to just kind of reflect on what we've gone through, to read. I write. Even speaking to you or connecting with you in part, I think, is a form of self-care, because it's re-identifying with who you are and why you're doing what you're doing. Very challenging to do in medicine, but very important. And the other aspect that's important is when you live things with your patients and you allow yourself to be with them, sometimes you grieve for them. So I certainly have had moments where I've come home from a very long day or very long month and felt a lot of emotions, and just validating the fact that that's okay. It's okay to feel sad. It's okay to say goodbye in your mind and your heart to the people that you took care of and that have passed on or that are going through a hard time.
That sounds incredibly healthy and challenging.
Challenging, yes.
Yeah. It's really wonderful hearing what you're saying on so many levels. And in the context of this blog and these interviews that I'm doing, you're just bringing up so many things that I think are remarkably inspiring and important to help people be inspired to follow their own heart and find a trust in what's going on in their own life, and to make decisions to really stay on the path that's the healthiest and most passionate for them. What does it mean to you to follow your heart?
I think that means listening to the little voice inside of you. I think that I didn't really understand that until I was sick, because I remember being a, when you shed a lot of your identity, or you shed a lot of what you are, which is a little bit what the cancer process, I think, did to me. I can't speak for anyone else's experience, because I think everyone's experience is very different, but that's what happened to me. I looked in that mirror and I shed that identity. I shed the young woman identity, because there was a question of an automatic question in my mind of my fertility and my future ability to be a woman, just by nature of the fact that I would be going through therapy, cancer treatments, and that medical student identity and that very high functioning identity that I'd always had. And so when you're left with yourself and your body, and you become more aware of what your body's going through, I remember not hearing much from my body until about 2 weeks after my treatments, my first chemo treatment. And all of a sudden I felt calm, or I felt at peace with myself. And that was that little voice inside of me that I kind of connected to, I think, on that day. And I remember going downstairs and saying to my mom, you know, whatever happens, I think it's going to be all right. And that little voice is always the one that I go back to in terms of following my heart, is, you know, what is the right thing to do? What at the end of the day, if I did this, would I go home and I would feel at peace with that little voice? That to me is what's following my heart. And because it is so important to me to give this kind of care to not only my patients, but my family, my friends, to honor this idea that I was put through a life debt situation, and that I still to this day, even if I'm 8 years out, know that I don't really know how much time I have left. And I never want to do things that I regret. So at the end of the day, that voice and I need to be in a good communication, or else I'll keep going back to the problem until I feel like there's a reconciliation between me and my voice.
I love that. Yeah. And I can really relate. it's also really exciting to me to be doing this new chapter of my life and just starting out as an Epona Quest instructor. So I'm working with horses and people to develop these different skills. And one of the wonderful people in my group learning to become an instructor with me in Arizona was a palliative care physician. Oh. And she has gone back home and has begun the process of integrating this into the medical residents as part of their education, and giving them some time at the farm and with the horses to really emphasize exactly what you said, to what I do and what she does and all these people who work with horses in this way, is to try to help us connect more with our body and with our intuition and with that little voice inside, to be really in sync with that. Because it's amazing how many times I know in my own life, my brain had a completely different opinion than that little voice. And I'm so glad to hear of people working with others in the medical field who are wanting to do that as well.
I think that, I mean, there's in medicine, what makes it really challenging as well is that you develop as you go along, and I'm still developing that, an ability to develop a clinical little voice too. I keep on talking about this distinction between human and clinical, not because I think that they're distinct entities. I think they need to work together. Mm-hmm. And I'm 8 years into my training and I still have another 4 years to go. And I still feel like I need to, especially on the clinical end, develop that little voice, because that little voice of what you think is going on and what you know is going on with your patient is going to help you with communicating with them. And that's why I think it's challenging when people sometimes will interact with younger medical students or residents. That's what they feel. They don't feel that clinical voice is very strong. And sometimes I think, I've certainly interacted with patients who are a little concerned by that interaction. And it's because you really need to develop it. You have to know the medicine, the textbook, and then the person and how things go, and develop that clinical intuition that allows you to have enough confidence to communicate that with your patient, especially when it comes to things that are uncertain. And that, I think, translates into the humanity aspect. So I think you really need there's been a lot of discussion in our field in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years about how to teach humanity. And I'm not too sure if you can really teach it, or it's something that comes with something else. Mm. So I'm still in that process. I still have, you know, just to learn the heme is another 4 years for specifically for malignant hematology. So I've only done 3. So I have another 4 to go. So,
wow. Well, I believe you'll get there. I believe that will become a strong voice for you too. And I like that you say that they need to work together. Yeah.
And it takes a long time to develop that. And I think being aware of that and reflecting on that and why one voice is not so certain is where you go to your mentors, you know, your older staff. Sometimes it's a different person, the one that you will trust to talk to about, you know, the clinical problem versus the human problem. But there's always people that are there to help us and mentor us and using that effectively and listening to that voice to really tailor you into someone who's really able to be honest and holistic with the way that you approach problems mm-hmm. in our field.
It's so great that you have those people to go to and have that kind of community and support within your field. As you were going through the various stages of your life and the different challenges, did you have any people that were trying to steer you off course?
Mm. I think that there were certainly certain people that had a hard time with what I was going through. I remember very distinctly in my medical class, people trying to help and really not helping when I had my diagnosis. People focused on things like, oh my goodness, you don't have time to preserve your fertility. No, this is a big topic actually in young adults with cancer. And me just being kind of like astounded in the sense that I was like, do you realize that I might be hospitalized in the next week or two? Cause I'm, you know, my cancer is making it very difficult for me to breathe. It's, you know, past my diaphragm and the prognosis remains good, but I was very sick at the beginning. And it amazed me that people would be focusing on something like that. I mean, it's something that was close to my heart, this idea that I might lose my fertility, but my life was more important. I need my life first before I could ever think about having a family or being a mom. So certainly people that put ideas into your head sometimes, or I remember certainly at the end of my treatments, I think that was the hardest part where people just didn't, they see it as cancer is something that's over. You know, it happened, you had it, it's over. That's not the truth, you know, and that's not the truth. I think for certainly any disease, cancer in particular, because of this fear of relapse and recurrence. But as I've gone along in my training, I actually see that a lot of my other patients with other types of diseases that don't go away or that are chronic also feel the same sort of feeling and trauma associated to what they went through. And having people kind of brush off your experience because it's something that's over or that they have a hard time discussing, those types of personalities had a tendency to try to want to derail me. Therefore, I just we stopped talking. You know, I made choices to keep people in my life who were able to sit there with me. And my really good friends, I mean, it was hard for them to sit with me sometimes. You know, people your own age that are in their early 20s that are watching you go through that, who love you very much, who it's hard for them to listen to some of these reflections about mortality in someone who's that young. Mm-hmm. But they stayed. They stuck with me. And even if they didn't want to go to that depth in their own minds, they still stayed. And those were the people that I kept in my life. And I'm very happy to have these people in my life.
Thank goodness for them.
Yes.
Would there be, I mean, I'm sure that there's all different contexts and possibilities, but could you think of 3 of the best things people could do or say if they have someone in their life who's going through cancer or concerned about it?
I think that listening, sometimes not saying anything and just listening, would be the number one thing. You know, and letting the person kind of guide the conversation in terms of what they're feeling, what they're afraid of, and what's going through their mind. I think that, you know, giving them inner strength and courage in the way that the really good people in my life did with me, you know, reminding me, Victoria, you're a strong person. You're a determined person. You know, we know that you want to go back to medicine and that you're going to do great things, and we're going to support you in that. You know, I think that being able to bring the person that you care about back to who they are, that's definitely the second most important thing. And the third important thing, I think, is a little bit what I said before, which is, you know, not if they're going to go somewhere that's difficult or hard, that's hard for you, don't necessarily let them know that it's hard for you. You know what I mean? If you're talking about a death or dying situation and that's something that you have a hard time talking about, don't brush off what the person is saying. I think it's okay to be honest with them and say, hey, this is really hard for me to talk to you about this, and I'm so sorry you're going through this. But don't brush it off. Don't tell them that it's not a possibility that they wouldn't die or that this bad thing might happen. You know, I think that getting through this type of experience comes with, from the person perspective of someone who's gone through it, is verbalizing what you're feeling and working through it, finding that courage, and in some ways reflecting on these more difficult life or death issues. So those would be the three things that I would say, and I think they come together with the idea of honesty, of honestly listening and being with someone.
I think that's fantastic advice. Yeah. And as you read in my blog, my mom had a great guest post where she talks a little bit about her own experience with cancer. And I won't speak 100% for her, but I'm quite sure she would agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. And I think it's really important to talk about that, because so often in people, even just hearing the C word can run for the hills. Yeah. And it's so important in our society and in our communities and in our families to be aware and prepared to do all those things you suggested, because it would be horrible to lose a relationship with someone because we can't be there for them when they need us most.
And I think that one of the reasons why the C word, I mean, this is my own, again, my own personal
sure.
interaction with this word, but one of the reasons why I think the C word is a difficult word is because it's a lot of the time society has a very specific perception of what it is to go through cancer and what a cancer patient looks like. Mm. Now, there's, you know, many other diseases that have, you know, difficult courses for patients, but this particular one is the one that society has a tendency to focus on and be feared of. And I think that that metaphor of survivor, of surviving something, of battling something, comes into play a lot. That all of a sudden, because you had this particular disease that happens to be named cancer, you're all of a sudden a warrior. And that creates all kinds of interesting dynamics between patients, their families, their doctors. And, you know, even in medical language that we use, we sort of use this word of survivorship. It's an existing word. And I think we have to be a little bit careful to know that even when the battle is over, the cancer still existed. You know, I think that part of the reason why people, you know, maybe for me certainly said that, oh, it's over now, is because I had vanquished it. It was gone. But that's not necessarily the reality. And for people who live with cancer chronically, because in many cases, cancer is now becoming a chronic disease, both solid cancers and hematological cancers, where people are living with it for 5 or 10 or 15 years, that's hard. It's hard for them to be seen as a warrior. That's not successful because it's still there. No, that's not the case at all. It's something that they're living with. And it's something that, you know, depending on how you choose to interpret it, that you never necessarily leaves you, or will come back and rear its head in different ways. You know, I never forget that I'm a cancer patient. I think my relationship with having been a cancer patient changes as I go along. But am I to this day proud that I survived that experience, or that I was part of that group of people? Absolutely. So that's I think part of the reason why it's hard to talk about, because of how it's perceived and what it's like to live it. They're two different things.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have anything that you'd like to share with our listeners before we conclude our interview today?
I mean, I think that the one thing, I think what you're doing is great. I think that having people sharing their stories, and you and your family sharing their stories in such an honest way about what they've been through and really talking about the real issues at hand, is important. And I would encourage anyone who's going through any sort of challenge, any sort of process, and certainly is going through a cancer diagnosis to really to know that the road is not easy. That the road can sometimes offer you unexpected things, sometimes unexpectedly good things, and that the best thing that you can do is do the things that make you feel comfortable, that make you feel like you're true to yourself. Because I think to this day, 8 years into medical training, I know that there's certain things I can't explain and certain things I can't control, and a lot of that has to do with time. So I encourage everyone to do what makes their heart beat the biggest, the brightest, and to make decisions that make them feel like in line with themselves. And when they're going through hard times, to try to go back to that instead of to listening to what other people might have to say, or listen to the people who are helping you get back to who you are, so that you can continue to follow your path and your heart, as I think is evidenced in the work that you're doing. That would be the advice or the words that I would have to say.
Thank you. And I hope our listeners got as much out of this interview as I did. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I wish you only the best on your journey ahead. I hope it is kind to you, and that the challenges you're able to overcome with as much grace and ease as possible. And I'm a big believer that you're going to become an incredible physician and person in the medical field, who I hope to see change things for the better all over the place. So, and I'm sure you already are.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you to our listeners. Till next time on My Horse Heart.